Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This week is the annual South by Southwest Music Festival down there in Austin, Texas. Thousands of bands have descended on the town, and the whole city is swimming in music, night and day, indoors and out. Our digital producer Mike Katziff is down there and found himself outside a restaurant early in the morning recording a song by the one-woman band Waxahachie. That one woman is Katie Crutchfield, and her song, accompanied by the occasional passing car or tweeting bird, is called Swan Dive. Waxahachie with Swan Dive, recorded by Soundcheck's Mike Katziff and engineer Rachel Neal in a relatively quiet corner of Austin, Texas during this week's noisy South by Southwest Music Festival. Hear the whole thing on our website, soundcheck.org. Later on the show, the Swedish band Shout Out Louds are in Austin, but before they left for Texas, they stopped by our New York studio for a live performance. And as long as we're talking about that part of the country, this might be a good time for me to remind you that we're not in Kansas anymore.
We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. We hear he is a wizard of a wiz, if ever a wiz there was.
Since it was first published in 1900, L. Frank Baum's novel, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, has been adapted for stage and screen more times than I can count. And somehow it hasn't seemed to diminish the story's popularity. In fact, the latest version, Disney's Oz the Great and Powerful, brought in more than $150 million during its opening weekend. Now, along with those many adaptations has come a great deal of music, and some of that is just as classic as the story itself. Joining me on the line is Wizard of Oz historian John Fricke. He's an Emmy Award-winning documentarian, the author of several books about the Wizard of Oz and Judy Garland, and a past president of the International Wizard of Oz Club. I didn't know there was such a thing, John. First of all, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you very much. Oh, the Oz Club's been going since 1957. It was founded by a young teenage boy in Brooklyn for people who were into the Frank Baum books and other Oz authors and the Oz series and the Oz illustrators, and it grew from 16 charter members to several thousand. And
wow.
This has been my passion since I was five, and you don't choose these things, they choose you. And I feel very fortunate that I was one of the chosen. How's that for pretentious?
Yeah. So the idea that this club was formed based on the books, though, and not
yes.
necessarily the movie is sort of interesting. And you say books plural, because Baum wrote many books in the Oz series, right?
Baum wrote 14 full-length Oz stories before he passed away, and then the Oz series was continued by six other authors until there were 40 official titles by 1963.
Wow.
And so Oz was as much the books and various stage adaptations and, you know, myriad things as it was Judy Garland and company, although certainly Judy and that film were already deep in the public's consciousness. The film had been one of the top hits of 1939. It had been reissued theatrically twice. And when CBS showed it in 1956, it drew 45 million people.
Wow. So is that where music first comes into the tale of Oz?
Oh, gosh, no. Frank Baum himself, after the book was published in 1900, wrote a stage musical for which he did the book and lyrics, and Paul Tietjens did the score. By the time it came to the stage a year later, the director, Julian Mitchell, had kind of cranked up the title and moved in extraneous characters and subplots and thrown out most of the Baum score and had other song hits interpolated. Uh-huh. And that musical was a huge success. In fact, it was as much the musical as the first book that led Baum to write sequels, because the musical was primarily about the Scarecrow and Tin Man, and children fell in love with the vaudevillian kind of antics. Their parents loved the spectacle and the kind of dry adult humor, and mm-hmm. the songs had virtually nothing to do with the story.
What year are we talking about there?
1902 to 1903. It opened on Broadway in 1903, and it ran on Broadway and or in national tours until 1909.
Well, I'm betting we're not going to find too many recordings of that music.
Well, David Maxine has done a really nice composite 2-CD set of piano rolls and old 78s, you know, cylinder discs, what does exist. Again, you can listen to it, but it isn't particularly Ozzy.
All right, well, let's talk about some specifically Ozzy music then.
Yes.
Judy Garland, composer Harold Arlen, the lyricist Yip Harburg, they set a pretty high bar.
Well, and that's the crazy thing now. You know, that movie, the 1939 Wizard of Oz, has so far gone beyond being a movie or even a popular movie. It is, you know, arguably the best-known, most familiar movie in terms of scenes, characters, and songs in history. And it's very difficult to compete or match reactions to that. First of all, because it's been around and been shown and reshown and re-embraced by every generation, but also because it's just so good.
Well, they won the Academy Award for Best Song for Guess Which One.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby. That you dare to dream really do come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me.
Judy Garland singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow from the 1939 filmed version of The Wizard of Oz, won the Academy Award for Best Song for composer Harold Arlen and lyricist Yip Harburg. Arlen and Harburg, though, John Fricke, were not responsible for the soundtrack, right? Just the songs.
Well, that's right. Although many of their Arlen's musical themes were incorporated into the musical score, and that won an Academy Award for Herbert Stothart at MGM. The best original score for a movie of 1939 was also Wizard of Oz.
A little bit of Herbert Stothart's score for the 1939 Wizard of Oz film. Now, John, I had heard that the film hadn't really been so hugely well received at first and that it had kind of fallen off the table, but you say that wasn't the case.
The legend that the film was not well received is very much a legend. Film was one of the top 10 critics' picks of 1939. It was one of the top 10 box office films of the year. It did not make a profit the first time around because two-thirds of the audience for Wizard of Oz were kids, and they paid less at the box office than adults did. So while the theaters were jammed, the money was not what it would have been if the seats had been filled by all grown-ups paying full price.
So what was on what did the reputation of the film rest during the, say, the 40s and the early 50s?
Oh, I think they brought it back 10 years later to the theaters, and it was a huge hit again. I think Garland's rising star all through the 1940s at MGM, that was the decade when she was in the top 10 box office, when she made the pictures with Mickey Rooney, For Me and My Gal, Meet Me in St. Louis, Easter Parade, that long list of musicals that had her such an audience favorite. And I think World War II at the first half of the 1940s helped as well, because Over the Rainbow became just kind of a song about what everybody was hoping for,
right,
against all odds during those rough years.
So the music, and specifically Judy Garland singing that music, really was a part of keeping this film sort of in the American consciousness.
The MGM movie and the songs really helped cement that. All of a sudden there were theme songs to associate with those popular characters.
And that would turn out not to be sort of the big exclamation point at the end of the sentence, but merely a semicolon, because the sentence would run on and on. 1975, John, we come to The Wiz, a musical retelling of the story in the context of African-American culture. What do you find appealing about this musical retelling of Oz?
Well, it went back to the original Baum plot even more than the MGM film had. It certainly brought a great sense of contemporary humor to the characters and the situations, perhaps so much so that the show isn't as classic and revivable as the MGM material is. You know, The Wiz was very much of its time, although what has kept it timeless is, again, the score.
Mm. So 1975, we've got Dorothy doing a little disco as she eases on down the road. Ease on down the road from the 1975 musical The Wiz, retelling the story of L. Frank Baum's novel The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Oz back in the news with the Disney film Oz the Great and Powerful that stars James Franco in the title role. And on the line with me is John Fricke. He's an Emmy Award-winning documentarian and the author of 6 books, all of which are centered on The Wizard of Oz or Judy Garland or both. And Judy Garland's daughter, Liza Minnelli, is front and center in a 1972 adaptation. Tell us about Journey Back to Oz, John.
Well, Journey Back to Oz, by the time it was released, was already a project that was 10 years old. In fact, all the stars, Liza Minnelli as Dorothy, Ethel Merman as the Wicked Witch, and right on down, had recorded their parts in 1962. So Liza was 16 when she recorded this. And then the producer ran out of money to complete the animation, and it took him a decade to get it all together, after which the film just kind of spluttered into a very, very brief theatrical release, matinees, showings, that kind of thing, before it ended up on TV. But originally there was great hopes for this, an all-star cast singing a score by Sammy Kahn and Jimmy Van Heusen, and it didn't work out to everybody's satisfaction, unfortunately, but some of the songs are catchy, and certainly Liza has the same energy at 16 as she's manifested all the decades since.
Mm. This is Liza Minnelli singing, in the role of Dorothy, the song Keep a Happy Thought.
Whenever the issue's in doubt, the optimist in me comes out. Whenever the future will not point the way to me, I gulp the slightest hope, and I say to me, I tell me, don't be preoccupied with things on the gloomy side. Your troubles are mostly magnified. All your foolish fears will come to naught if you'll only keep happy thoughts. The point is, don't.
that is Liza Minnelli, recorded when she was 16 years old, and Keep a Happy Thought from the animated movie Journey Back to Oz. And John Fricke, you were telling us the songs for this movie were written by Sammy Kahn and Jimmy Van Heusen.
And there's a major team, if ever there was one.
Yeah, so along with Arlen and Harburg, or Charlie Smalls, the Tony Award-winning composer of The Wiz, this story has attracted some pretty major composers over the course of the years.
I think it's because the property itself is so universal. Certainly by the time we're into the 1970s now, 60s and 70s, the MGM film was an annual television event and a major event because there wasn't home video. You could only see that film once a year, and everybody looked forward to it. And people had grown up with those songs, and a lot of the people who wanted to write for movies and for film coming along, it was like, wow, we could do an Oz project because those characters are public domain. The book was out of copyright at that point. And attraction to all that.
I was going to ask you, what happened in the 70s where suddenly, you know, we have The Wiz, we have Journey Back to Oz, both of which we've mentioned, but then there was, I remember an animated series on Saturday morning, a Saturday morning cartoon series, may not have had a long run, but it was definitely there. And then there was this really weird sci-fi movie called Zardoz, Wizard of Oz. I mean, it's just like, you know, everywhere you turned, it seemed, there was a Wizard of Oz just sort of like, you know,
well, I think that's
lurking in the corner.
A, it was public domain. You know, right now anybody can do anything they want with Baum's characters and plot points as long as they don't resemble the MGM incarnations of the plot or the characters. And with that kind of freedom and the idea that you had a built-in audience, you didn't have to explain Oz to an audience in advance or set it up. Everybody had a concept of Oz. You just had to kind of get them on board with yours and hope that it would fly. Unfortunately, The Wiz was about the only thing theatrically that did after the MGM film up to that time. Since then, now we've had two more blockbusters, and I assume we're going to segue into those.
Well, Wicked turns
yes.
10 this year with music by Stephen Schwartz. Now, you mentioned fan fiction earlier. This is based on a 1995 novel. So 95 years after Baum writes, you know, the wonderful Wizard of Oz, a Gregory Maguire writes a book called Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West. So is this, I don't want to say it's fan fiction because it was genuinely published and all that kind of stuff, but it's coming out of the same kind of place, it seems.
Oh, I think so. You know, with Gregory Maguire, you've got a professional journalist, professional author, professional imagination to the nth degree, and he has totally refashioned Baum's Oz and Baum's characters on a very adult level. When Wicked, the first of his four Oz books, was adapted for the stage by Stephen Schwartz and his cohorts a decade or more ago, they considerably softened it and put a real musical theater and musical comedy touch to it and emphasized the association between the Wicked Witch and the Good Witch, Glinda, and how things aren't always as black and white as they're painted or as they seem. And as a result, that show has just taken off to the extent that I think over Christmas week, they did an extra performance, and the grosses, you know, got close to $2 million for 1 week of theater just in New York.
Right. So from the score to Wicked, here is a song called For Good.
Because I knew you, I have been changed for good. And just to clear the air, I ask forgiveness. The things I've done, you blame me for. But then I guess we know there's blame to share, and none of it seems to matter anymore. Like a comet goes forward as it passes a wind off the sea.
Kristen Chenoweth and Idina Menzel with for Good, written by Stephen Schwartz for the musical Wicked, based on a book about the Wicked Witch of the West, and now 10 years running, a huge hit on Broadway, and yet another kind of musical spin-off of the franchise of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, the 1900 L. Frank Baum novel. John Fricke's on the line with us, and John, you said that post-70s there were sort of two major additions to the Oz canon. One of them is Wicked. What's the other?
The other opened just a few days ago, and that's Disney's Oz the Great and Powerful, the James Franco, Mila Kunis film that, as you said at the beginning, racked up a worldwide gross of $150 million in 3 days.
Now, have you seen it?
Oh, try and stop me.
What do you think?
Oh, I had a wonderful time. I enjoyed it. I think certainly the film has gotten mixed notices,
yep.
But one thing that I observed in reading everything I could in this last week or so is that, you know, it's being reviewed by a lot of people for what isn't there, as opposed to sitting back and admiring what is. You know, if it's not their concept of Oz, it's Sam Raimi's concept of Oz and Disney's concept of Oz. And as long as it is a sweeping, beautiful entertainment, which it really is, one can nitpick here and there. But I found it very, very effective. And if it's not Baum's Oz, well, then certain things about The Wiz and definitely things about Wicked and the MGM film were not Baum's Oz either.
Mm.
But they keep that spirit.
And the soundtrack is by Danny Elfman, who people will know from Batman and The Simpsons and so many other sort of iconic scores. Do you think this one is likely to be a kind of a hit for him?
Well, I think it's wonderfully evocative, and I think it accompanies the picture brilliantly. Of course, he only got to write a brief little ditty for the Munchkins. There are no other songs in the film. There's just a lot of beautiful underscoring. But, again, it's a throwback. It's kind of homage to the 1939 Wizard, mm-hmm. where MGM's Roger Edens had the idea for a huge Munchkin production number welcoming Dorothy, and Arlen and Harburg took that idea and brought all their own original material to it. And if indeed there's only 30 seconds of song in Oz the Great and Powerful, it's a nice tip of the hat to what has gone before.
The prophecy was clear, the wind would bring you here, and so it was, a man named Oz would magically appear. So sound the battle call,
Oz the Great and Powerful, number one film in the land right now, music by Danny Elfman. John Fricke has been with us. The Emmy Award-winning documentarian has written 6 books centered on The Wizard of Oz or Judy Garland or both, and has been talking us through the musical history of The Wizard of Oz. And John, before you leave, I have to ask, Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, does it sync up with the movie or what?
Who cares? And that's the kind of bitter traditionalist I am. You know, I've heard all the legends, and I've heard Pink Floyd deny them. And to be honest with you, I'm a child of the 60s. I'm supposed to be into all of that, the Beatles and the Stones and everything after. By the 1960s, I was so into Judy and Sinatra and Broadway scores and Hollywood scores that, you know, 3 guitars and a drum were just not going to cut it for me after 33 pieces playing Mort Lindsey orchestration. So I'm not a good judge. Pink Floyd could set up in the living room and offer to accompany the film, and I would say, when you're done, fellas, lock the door. I'll be back later.
John Fricke, thank you so much for being with us.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
This is Soundcheck. A little bit of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. I've never tried it myself, but legend has it that if you start the record at the second lion's roar at the beginning of the MGM film, you get all these weird coincidences between the score and the film. Whatever. This is Soundcheck, and tonight on the show we're playing some of the recordings that our digital producer Mike Katziff is sending back from the South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas. Here's the British band Alt-J, winners of last year's Mercury Prize in Britain. They played the NPR Music Showcase last night at Stubbs, one of the major venues at South by Southwest. And this is their song, Dissolve Me. It's Alt J, live at South by Southwest. And Alt J live at the South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas last night. You can hear their full set and other live performances from the festival in Austin on our website, soundcheck.org. The Swedish band Shout Out Louds is playing at South by Southwest this week. We'll hear their recent in-studio session later on the show. But first, Joe Levy of Billboard magazine will join us to talk about the latest dispatch from the late Jimi Hendrix. This is Soundcheck.
We got beer in a tub and some good-looking girls dressed to the nines, looking for a good time. Jacked-up trucks stacked in thick, white rocks stuck in the mud grips, and a big...
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The number one album on the Billboard chart this week is from this artist, 36-year-old country star Luke Bryan.
If you ain't here to party, you picked the wrong place, you picked the wrong Friday night. You ain't here to party, you'll be missing out.
Right behind him at number two is a musician who hasn't recorded a new song for more than 36 years.
Well, I hear my train a-coming.
Yes, Jimi Hendrix is on the charts this week for a posthumous album called People, Hell and Angels. As it turns out, Jimi Hendrix has now released more albums in death than when he was alive. Joining us to discuss this is Billboard editor and Soundcheck regular Joe Levy. Hey, Joe.
Hey, how you doing?
So, Jimi Hendrix debuting at number two.
At number two.
Is
Isn't
that a surprise?
Amazing? It's a little bit of a surprise. It's actually something that we've known about for a while. This projection has been in place for a while. The record company, which in this case is Sony Legacy, they specialize in reissues. They told Billboard they're treating this as a frontline release. They want it to be as big a deal as if the Beatles made a new record. And they've actually been eyeing this for number one or two, although I don't know if they would admit that they were eyeing number one because they didn't get there, for quite a while. So I expected this, and I'm still a little amazed.
So how, I mean, just because the record company wants it to happen doesn't mean it's going to happen. People had to go out and buy the record. So who's buying these Jimi Hendrix records made of these tapes that were left behind when he'd passed away?
Right. Hendrix left hundreds of hours of material that has been exploited almost from the very moment of his death, a subject of some controversy. Now the Hendrix family is in control of the estate, so we're getting the raw, unfiltered Jimi. Who buys it? I do, actually. So guys like me who love Hendrix and who enjoy the prospect of a lot of live Hendrix or a lot of studio Hendrix with fairly free-flowing improvisation, but also kids who love classic rock, kids who are thrilled to find out new Jimi Hendrix, confusing, let me investigate.
Yeah, yeah.
Casual fans who might want a t-shirt because this album, if you buy it at Best Buy, comes in a package with a t-shirt. Maybe just someone who was sitting at home and in January heard the six, count them six songs that they played from this record during an episode of Hawaii Five-0 on CBS.
Wow.
This is a marketed record.
Talk about product placement.
Exactly.
So the story behind the record is they're claiming that with all these hours and hours of tapes, you know, it seems like Hendrix just constantly had the tape machine rolling whenever he was just like noodling around with musicians in the studio. They're saying this is it for studio recordings.
Yes, this supposedly will be the very last all-new Jimi Hendrix record. And that is one of the amazing things about it, is that it's marketed as 12 never-before-heard songs, even though some versions of these same songs were on the last new Hendrix record, The Valley of Neptune.
Right. Well, I wanted to ask you about your use of the term all-new, because, I mean, if we hear a song like Somewhere, haven't we heard this somewhere before?
Indeed, Somewhere, which was the first single. There was an actual single from this record. But Somewhere, yes, you have heard this somewhere before. Specifically, you first heard it in the mid-70s on Crash Landing, one of the Alan Douglas-produced tracks.
Alan Douglas was
a label owner himself, put in charge of the Hendrix tapes, famous and despised among hardcore fans for wiping the bass and drum tracks, leaving the lead guitar and vocals, and bringing in musicians, and they always point out many of whom never even knew Jimi Hendrix,
right,
to overdub on top of it. As a kid, I heard some of these records, and I didn't hate them, and mm-hmm. I don't hate them now. But this is a different version of Somewhere that was on that album, and a totally different version of Somewhere than was on, again, The Valleys of Neptune,
right,
which came out just 3 years ago.
So Jimi Hendrix died in 1970 and has once again been hitting the charts in recent years. He is at number 2 on the Billboard charts this week with the album People, Hell, and Angels.
Touching a promised land, I hear pleas and prayers and a desperate whisper saying, "Oh Lord, please give us a helping hand." Yeah.
Song is called "Somewhere." It's against all odds new from Jimi Hendrix. The long-deceased electric guitarist and singer and songwriter. His posthumous album is at number 2 on the Billboard charts this week. It's called People, Hell, and Angels. That is a version of an old song. They're all old songs. They're Jimi Hendrix songs, Joe Levy. Who's playing with him on this version of Somewhere?
Interestingly enough, that is Stephen Stills on bass.
Really? From yep. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young?
Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. Buddy Miles on drums. Buddy Miles, of course, the Hendrix friend who he reconnected with for Band of Gypsies.
Mm-hmm.
This music comes from the period when the Experience was breaking up or had broken up, and it is valued or thought to be interesting because much of it seems to point in new directions that Hendrix did not have time to fully explore. But is there great material on this record? Yes.
Really?
There is some great material. It depends on your interest in listening to Jimi Hendrix improvise.
Hmm.
There are takes of blues tracks that he recorded what seems like dozens of times. Bleeding Heart, for instance, is a much slower version than we've heard before. It drifts away from blues and more towards the Hendrix ballad come to know and love.
Let's hear a little bit of Jimi Hendrix's version of the Elmore James song Bleeding Heart from his new record, People, Hell, and Angels.
Thank you.
always were those blues roots in Jimi Hendrix's playing, and there he is doing another version of a song he returned to numerous points during his short life, Bleeding Heart by Elmore James. Jimi Hendrix from the new album, sitting at number 2 on the Billboard charts this week, called People, Hell, and Angels. We're speaking with Billboard editor Joe Levy about this phenomenon of the artist who has been more prolific in death than in life.
He is, I believe, the 6th best-selling catalog artist of the SoundScan era. Obviously, number 1 is the Beatles, number 2, Elvis Presley, Zeppelin, Bob Marley, The Doors, and then Jimi Hendrix, right behind The Doors, who have sold, since 1991, 16.8 million albums, Hendrix 16.7, and now obviously in a position with some momentum to overtake them.
Notable by their absence from that list, the Rolling Stones.
Well, the Rolling Stones would not specifically, I mean, they're actually making new music, so they wouldn't specifically benefit from some of, let us say, you know, they have catalog sales to be sure, but they wouldn't specifically benefit from the effect of nostalgia and posthumous releases every single one of these artists have benefited from. There are no, in this top 10, there are no active artists. After Hendrix, it's the Grateful Dead, Marvin Gaye, Patsy Cline, and Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble.
Wow. Well, there is Jimi Hendrix right behind the very much still with us Luke Bryan at the top of the Billboard charts this week. Jimi Hendrix at number 2 with the album called People, Hell, and Angels. And so this is it for studio stuff, Joe, but
they're saying this is it for studio stuff. There is still live material. They've released plenty of it. They've taken single disc compilations and made them into 4-disc expansions. The Experience Hendrix Project has released authorized bootlegs. They've actually identified a market of collectors and passionate fans, and they're servicing them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in these records. Hendrix made music of possibilities. Those possibilities still speak to us. He didn't make a music about conclusions. It was very open-ended. It was a different time and place when people were searching for new ways to use the electric guitar, new ways to make songs. And I think we haven't reached the bottom of the well in listening to this music.
All right. Joe Levy, editor at Billboard and a Soundcheck regular, thanks once again for being with us.
Good to be here.
This is Soundcheck. The new Jimi Hendrix album is called People, Hell, and Angels. It's at number 2 on the Billboard charts, and you can read Joe Levy's blog post about it on our website, soundcheck.org. If you can't make it to South by Southwest this week, soundcheck.org is giving you a taste of what's happening on some of the stages down there in Austin, Texas. Trevor Powers is a musician who records under the name Youth Lagoon, and he just released his second album, Wondrous Bughouse. Here is Youth Lagoon performing last night on the NPR Music Stage at Stubbs in Austin, Texas, with a song called 17. That's Youth Lagoon, the song 17, performing last night in Austin, Texas at the South by Southwest Music Festival. Thanks to NPR Music for the recording. Up next, a performance in our studio from the band Shout Out Louds. This is Soundcheck.
I swear you'll leave your...
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. All this week, we are covering the South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas. The Swedish band Shout Out Louds is playing several shows at the South by Festival. But last week, before they set out for Texas, they dropped into the Soundcheck studio here in New York to record a session. Shout Out Louds has made highly danceable indie rock for the past 10 years, but their latest release, called Optica, sounds more like a meticulously constructed pop album. Well, here's an example. The Shout Out Louds playing their song Blue Ice in the Soundcheck studio.
Speak, you want everything I own, everything you want. Do I keep running away, running away, running away? You keep fading away, fading away, fading away. It always ends in the same way. The sun gets in. Next time, there's blue eyes. Came out of the blue. Came out of the blue. They never leave, they never change it, does it? And there, but a city, a moment is breaking my promise. I keep drifting away, drifting away, drifting away. You keep fading away, fading away, fading away. It always ends the same way. The sun gets in your eyes. I won't be surprised next time. This blue eyes, this blue eyes.
Same, same, same. The sun gets in.
From Sweden, the band Shout Out Louds, live on Soundcheck with their song Blue Ice, which appears on their new album called Optica. Let me introduce you to the members of Shout Out Louds. Adam Ulenius singing and
That's
playing
correct,
guitar.
Yes.
Ted Malmros playing the bass. Hi, Ted.
Hello there.
Bevan Stenborg is playing the keyboard.
Hi.
Actually, keyboards. You've got several over there.
Yeah.
And Carl von Arben playing guitar, doing some backing vocals. Lars Skoglund behind the drum kit, playing a little electronic drums as well. Adam, Blue Ice almost sounds like you're singing Blue Eyes, and you do kind of play on that, seems, in the song.
You're right, yeah. It started off actually called Blue Eyes. Well, that was like 3 years ago, so we worked a lot with the lyrics and words on that, so yeah. Mm-hmm. It actually was a very fast version when we recorded it at the beginning. So,
after 3 years of thinking about it, when you finally did it, it came pretty fast.
Yeah.
Well, we actually did it a couple of versions first.
Mm-hmm. Including last year, a version on ice, literally. You released, there were 10 of them, right? 10 mm-hmm. singles. Pressed on ice. Explain how that happened.
Well,
it was really a
kit with a mold
right.
and a bottle of water. So you had, in order to hear it, you had to make it yourself.
Now, I wanted to ask about that. Is that bottle just water, or are there chemicals in
it? No,
it's
something? No chemicals. It's just it's distilled, or
okay,
yeah, unionized.
You know, it's water from Swedish rivers.
Yeah. No, but
for Swedish rivers.
That would be cool. Well, no, but it's good to have it. You know. No air bubbles in it, or not too many minerals.
So
it affects quality.
The idea was you poured this distilled water into the mold, froze it,
yep,
and then you came out with a 7-inch single.
Yeah,
made
you
of ice.
Then you have to just peel the mold away, and
right?
Flip it around and put it on your record player. And a lot of people are very worried about the record player, but it does not really harm the record player because I mean the ice is pretty thick; it doesn't melt that quick, and it's it's also on, you know, good disc under the record player. So,
right,
we haven't broken any record label.
I don't know, okay.
Unless you fall asleep, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not the one for the after party.
No. So is the song about sort of the passage of time, the fading away of relationships or love or something like that?
I mean,
is that why you chose a medium that would fade away, that would melt away?
Yeah, I mean, it fitted really the song, and we even talked about how do we get an MP3 sort of fade away? We just every time you listen to it, just like becomes the volume is just lower.
It was possible to make a self-destructing MP3, but it wouldn't break down in a nice way.
Mm.
So. And then we're like, it's called Blue Ice. What can we do? And then it just.
So you found a way to make a record out of ice.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm.
Now, Ted, let me ask you about Optica, the new record. I mean, the idea of time and things fading away. I mean, this album seems to be about time and light and things like that.
Yeah, and I think it became pretty evident fairly quickly. Last record we recorded in a big, bright studio in Seattle, and this time we kind of dug ourselves into a dungeon without windows. So somehow, pretty early in the recording process, we're like, there's no light here, so we have to create our own light.
Mm-hmm. And it became a keyword also for the songs, how we wanted to have the bright sound to it. And we talked about songs sounding different, you know, if it's sunset or in the middle of the night. It was just like a nice to have like a word to describe songs rather than just talking about other bands and other.
You know, some years ago I was in, actually it was Finland, but I had gone to interview a bunch of musicians and it was November.
Mm-hmm.
And
nice.
nobody was in, all the big musicians were in the south of France. And the reason they gave was, it's winter, there's no light. Everybody who can get out of town is out of town, you know, down on the Mediterranean where they have light. I mean, this is something you guys have to deal with in Scandinavia, right?
Every bloody year.
Yeah.
So
8 months of the year. But I think also, in a lot of ways, I think it could be positive, too. Not, you know, to be there and dig in. It's good because, the worth ethic is higher.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely did more in less time this time than if you could play football, barbecue a little bit, and right. go to the beach, you know. If you can't do any of that, you can just be in the studio then.
Mm-hmm. So around this time of year when the sun is returning, I mean, are people like, is it just like, you know, a free-for-all? People are out in the streets?
A little bit, but it's still a month or two away.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
you're, but, I mean, you're still considerably
you really,
further north
yes.
than we are.
You
yeah.
really feel mm-hmm. and see the change.
So anyway, so Optica, the title, sort of refers to that, right?
Yeah.
The
mm-hmm.
title of the record?
Optics is, yeah, the science of light, of course.
We're talking with the members of Shout Out Louds, the Swedish band. They are performing here in New York at Webster Hall on Friday, May 10th. Their album, their latest, is called Optica. And you want to do another song for us?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Sugar is the
Sugar,
song?
Yeah.
All right. Once again, Shout Out Louds is the band, and you're listening to Soundcheck. They're performing live here in the studio. Right now, here's Sugar from the Shout Out Louds album called Optica.
I've been trembling in the dark too long. Now I know what I've been
That's called Sugar, the Swedish band Shout Out Louds, live here in our New York studio on Soundcheck. The band is playing at Webster Hall here in New York on Friday, May 10th. They've been playing for us here in the studio. Thank you all for coming in and playing for us today.
Thank you.
The band is Shout Out Louds. This is Soundcheck.
Take me down on the 14th of July. How are we gonna celebrate?
There's more where that came from. Hear more from Shout Out Louds on our website at soundcheck.org. That's going to do it for the show today. Tomorrow, online at 2 p.m., it's the Portland-based electronic group that we'll call STRFKR, performing in our studio. Listen in, 2 p.m. Eastern on soundcheck.org. Then on the air at 9 tomorrow, it's a conversation with Richard Hell, talking about his new book, I Dreamed I Was a Very Clean Tramp, an autobiography. And our South by Southwest coverage continues with more live music, and singer-songwriter Devendra Banhart gets pressed into service as Soundcheck's Man on the Street Austin reporter. That's tomorrow on Soundcheck. More coverage of South by Southwest online at soundcheck.org. See you back here tomorrow night at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.
Take me down on the 14th of July. Take me to the fire.